Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Save big money on your roofing project at Menards with Owens Corning Shingles. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements and enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning Duration Shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 24 colors of Owens Corning Duration Shingles and transform your home today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, September 17th, 2025, and on today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. We'll have a spoiler-filled discussion about the new movie, The Long Walk. We'll talk a little about Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues, and then BJ is going to tell me about Gen V Season 2 and present some interviews with the people behind that show. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at SlashFilm.com, and it's just me in this news segment here. Everyone's fairly busy with work at the site. Once again, I encourage everyone to just visit SlashFilm.com and see all the stuff that we have cooking up for you all the time over there. So I have to start off with some sad news, and I'm sure everyone knows this by now, but Robert Redford died yesterday at age 89. Just a titan of Hollywood, an Oscar-winning director, one of the best actors Hollywood has ever seen. I would say for our younger listeners who may not have taken the time to dive back into his filmography yet, I have 7 movies that I think would be a really good starting place that gives you a good breadth of what he was capable of as an actor. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Sting, 3 Days of the Condor, All the President's Men, Sneakers, All is Lost, and a film called The Hot Rock, which I caught up with for the first time a few years ago, and it's just a really, really fun heist movie. If you watch all of those, I think you'll have a pretty good idea of why Redford was just a legend in the film world. And that's not even to mention the fact that he co-founded the Sundance Film Festival, which, I mean, the impact of that alone on the film community and the industry at large is immeasurable. So rest in peace to Robert Redford. Just wanted to open the show paying quick tribute to him. And if you've not seen All is Lost, I really recommend checking that out. He says something like 50 words in the whole movie, and the entire film is just Robert Redford's character on a boat, and he wakes up and realizes that there's a hole in his boat. The boat has crashed in the night, and he has to figure out how to survive, basically. And it's a very unusual movie, but man, Redford is great in it. So definitely check out some of his work if you're not super familiar with him. Okay, so moving on, there's no good way to transition out of the talking about the death of a legend, but I wanted to mention a couple of the Emmy winners that were announced this past Sunday night. The Pitt ended up winning for Best Drama, which I was very surprised by because I thought Severance would win for its second season, because that show, I believe, had more nominations than any other show going into this award ceremony. And everyone seemed to love Severance Season 2, except for Chris and I, who did a whole podcast about it. And we talked a lot on that episode about how we were kind of frustrated with the show. And so I was very happy to see The Pitt come away with that trophy, because I personally agree with this choice. I think the first season of The Pitt is a much better season of television than Severance Season 2, even though they're doing very, very different things. But yeah, regardless, I was happy to see that. The Studio ended up being a big winner throughout the night. Seth Rogen won, I think it was 4 Emmys, acting, writing, directing, and producing. And that's just very, very impressive. And that's a great show. So I was happy to see that show be rewarded as well. Adolescence was another one that performed extremely well. The Netflix sensation that came out, I believe it was earlier this year. And wow, just yeah, what a show. If you've not seen that show yet, do yourself a favor and check it out. It's structurally and formally unlike pretty much every other show that was nominated. I just wanted to give a very quick shout out to Catherine Lanasa, who won for Best Supporting Actress in a Drama for The Pitt. And that was like a big upset. And I thought she was terrific on that show and was very happy to see her win. Shout out also to Hannah Einbinder from Hacks, who won her first Emmy for Best Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series. So go check out her acceptance speech if you haven't seen that yet. If you want to find out more about the winners of the Emmys, you can check out, we've written a few articles at Slash Film. I think there are other websites that did like a full breakdown, but those are the big ones that I wanted to mention here. So next up, David Ellison and the folks who are now running Paramount are working on trying to buy Warner Brothers Discovery. And I think we talked about this possibility a little while ago, but it was before David Ellison and Skydance ended up taking over Paramount. So now that that transaction has been completed and Ellison is in charge of that studio, he's just quickly moving on to trying to swallow up Warner Brothers as well. And that seems really, really bad. That's not something that I would like to see happen, because if those two studios become one, yes, I guess the argument is that like maybe they, with their powers combined, they could create a streaming service that would combine all of the assets of Paramount Plus with HBO and HBO Max and everything that's there from those two companies, that could present a way that they could compete with Netflix and Disney Plus and all that. But at what cost is my question to that? Because if you take Warner Brothers off the board as a studio and it just gets subsumed into another company, we've talked about this before, that's one fewer place that filmmakers will be able to go to pitch ideas, and one fewer studio with its own identity and stamp that it can place on Hollywood, let alone the Hollywood history that is on that Warner Brothers lot and that lives inside the bones of that studio. And just what that would mean for a major studio like Warner Brothers to be sucked up by Paramount, and who knows what the Ellisons are actually going for. There's been reports that they're looking to try to buy TikTok as well. All this is still relatively early stages, so who knows exactly how it's going to shake out. But whew, I am just completely disheartened by this idea, and I feel like it would not be a great thing. And in fact, we actually have an article up at Slash Film that's called Paramount Wants to Buy Warner Brothers, and that would be a disaster for the movies. And Jeremy Smith wrote that. So I'm going to link to that in the show notes and encourage people to check that out. Just a couple more news items here before we jump into the real thrust of this episode. Nintendo is working on a sequel to the Super Mario Brothers movie, and we knew that was going to happen, but we did not know what it was going to be called. And now we know the name of that film is the Super Mario Galaxy movie, and it's going to be in theaters on April 3rd, 2026. So that seems relatively soon, all things considered. For an animated movie that is has to be very, very expensive. And so I'm surprised that that's actually going to come up like in whatever it is, 7 months or something along those lines. So you can read a little bit more about what this might mean at slashfilm.com. I am not, I've played my fair share of Mario games in the past, but the Super Mario Galaxy idea, I never played that game. I never played its sequel. The space component, I'm woefully behind on when it comes to all things Mario. So I'm not the best source for this, but we do have people who know what they're talking about writing about that at Slash Film. So check that out. We have a couple links in the show notes there. And then this last story is just one of those like, what are we doing here, folks, kind of things. So Sherlock Holmes is getting a new TV series, and it's going to be an animated show. And the twist, I guess you could call it, is that they're trying to put an adult spin on the world of Sherlock. So I'm going to read a quote here. This is from Nicholas Sercombe of Harry King Television, which is the company that's trying to put this thing together. The quote is, "Taking the animation route allows us to reimagine Sherlock Holmes on a grander, more imaginative, and risque scale than before. Together, we are creating our very own Sherlock Holmes universe that feels both timeless and completely fresh, rich in character, humor, and adventure. We can't wait for animated Sherlock to surprise audiences globally and imbue one of the world's most beloved literary icons with newfound energy." So yes, it is going to be called Animated Sherlock, which I go back to the drawing board on that name there, people. What are, again, what is going on? So This is supposed to be based on a series of books called The Unexpurgated Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, which was not written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, but is evidently meant to be Watson's uncensored accounts of Sherlock's investigations. So your guess is as good as mine on this one, people. I don't really have much more to add. I'm just kind of baffled by the state of things right now. I guess I shouldn't be. And this very well could just be like a British series that American audiences never think about again, even if it does come out and get kind of splashy casting or something. But yeah, that is what's going on in the world of film and TV news right now. Luckily, we have some good conversations coming up here, so let's jump right into those.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Oh, and one more time, the conversation you're about to hear about The Long Walk is a spoiler-filled discussion. If you don't want to hear that, skip ahead, check out the show notes. I put some time codes in there, or at least approximate time codes. So yes, here we go. With me now to talk about Francis Lawrence's The Long Walk, we have Slash Film editor and chief film critic Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
And Slash Film editor BJ Colangelo.
Hi, hi, hiya.
Okay, so The Long Walk. Wow, what a movie. I felt like this film was holding up a mirror to modern American life in a very disturbing way, particularly in regard to the desensitization we have to gun violence. There's a moment when someone gets shot early on, and Peter, who is played by David Johnson, right? That's the actor's name. Says something like, "I keep hoping that gets a little easier to deal with." And Ray, who is played by Cooper Hoffman, replies, "That's what I'm afraid of." And that line really hit me. So I guess just to open up this conversation, did you all find the movie's allegory to be effective? Did it work for you? Chris, I'll start with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was genuinely surprised at how unflinchingly brutal the movie is. Like, I had read the book, so I knew the book was obviously brutal. And, you know, they'd spent years trying to bring this to the screen. And one of the problems they had bringing it to the screen is that it was such a brutal book, they weren't sure they could execute it. No pun intended there. They weren't sure if they could do it right. And it was considered sort of like an unfilmable book. So I was kind of expecting them to maybe water it down a little bit, and they really do not at all. And I watched this two nights in a row. I watched this back to back 2 days in a row because I had to do a thing about it. And watching it like twice like that back in a row really hammered home how like relentlessly bleak this is for a studio film. I'm very impressed about that. I'm generally curious to see how it goes over with the general public, because I don't think they're ready for how unflinchingly hard this movie goes. Like, it does not pull its punches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what do you think, BJ? Was the metaphor or allegory effective for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we are constantly in cycles, unfortunately also cycles of violence, and this is the source material is something that King started writing when he was a teenager against the backdrop of the Vietnam War. And the fact that we are telling the exact same story with some of the dialogue pulled straight from the book and presenting it in 2025, and it is just as effective today, it feels just as relevant today, I think really speaks to how, as much as things change, they stay exactly the same. So that was pretty harrowing to watch. But in terms of the violence of it all, what's been really interesting is this movie is now officially the, you know, highest rated King adaptation on Rotten Tomatoes, which we all know is an imperfect algorithm. But when I was looking at, you know, it was like 100% for a couple days, and then there were like two or three negative reviews, and I was like, all right, what do the people have to say that gave this a negative review? And the two that I found most interesting, because one is just a person who's a grade A hater, and I'm not even going to give her airtime. But the other two were people that were like, I think this movie is too violent. I think this movie is too graphic. I don't think that I learned anything by seeing how brutal this is. And I had this moment where I was like, God, what a privileged existence you must have to not be actually concerned about this level of a threat of violence targeted towards you every single day. Because for so many people, like, this is a reality. And I very much subscribe to the Alan Clark school of filmmaking on violence. He's a British filmmaker from the 70s that I'm weirdly obsessed with. And a lot of his stuff inspires Gus Van Sant, including Elephant, because he made a film called Elephant that he just ripped off. And that is, you know, one of the most famously graphic violent movies about young people. But they showcase the violence in a very big way because, in their words, to sanitize it or to cut back on it would be to betray the reality. And unfortunately, gun violence is a reality. And so by actually showing how bad it is and not pretending that it's like a cool, fun, shoot 'em up Hollywood gun violence, I think is very important.
Yeah, I think they really come out of the gate pretty strong with that. The first execution in this movie, I think it's shown in the trailer, and then the trailer cuts away from it, but the movie version lingers on the person's face, just with a giant hole being blown into it, and like the jaw is separated from the face. It's like, it's very, very graphic. And I think that's when the title kicks on. So it's like a delayed title reveal, which I really
like. I timed it the second time I watched it. The title card comes up exactly 20 minutes into the movie, which is
wow.
Very cool. I'm a big fan of late title cards. Like Drive My Car has one that comes up like 40 minutes into the movie.
I love that. But yeah, they really like do not shy away from that and drop you in and force you to look at this and say, like, this is what we have in store for you. Because this movie is about a bunch of kids just trekking along and getting picked off one by one, it becomes this microcosm of society, right? These people, this relatively small group of characters each one of these characters begins to represent a certain idea that is reflected in our modern culture. And I was just curious what you all thought about the way the relationships and the dynamics between these young men worked on screen, and if you thought one was maybe too obnoxious, or if you thought one was maybe too over the top or too on the nose in terms of what it was supposed to be representing. Like there are a lot of ideas in this movie represented by these characters and the dialogue they have. So Chris, what'd you think about that?
You know, the movie is very deliberately sort of like following the formula of a war movie, and not just a Vietnam War movie, because obviously, like BJ said, when Stephen King wrote this, the Vietnam War was happening. It's very much sort of like a World War II movie. Like you think of like Saving Private Ryan, where they have like all the guys from different backgrounds. Like there's the guy from Brooklyn, and there's the religious sniper guy. It's like they're all like different background guys, and so they're sort of doing that here too. I was actually really impressed with how they handled all these characters and made them all distinct. They sort of like combined some characters from the books into like one or two people here, and I think that works a little better. And I was generally impressed with how they sort of make everyone here likable in a way, even not likable, but like sort of like you understand where they're coming from. Like of all the kids, or not really kids, of all the guys, like Barkovich, played by Charlie Plummer, is the worst of them because he's just an obnoxious guy who's like taunting people along the way. But even him, like in his very last scene, he has that sort of like come to Jesus moment where he's like sort of apologizing for being a piece of shit the entire time. Mm-hmm. And you can't help but sort of, you know, if not sympathize with him, you can empathize with him. You can tell that, like, you know, this guy, there's something like maybe mentally off about this guy. He clearly actually does feel bad for getting that kid killed. And like, he, you know, he's not, he's not like a villain. He's just a messed up kid living in this messed up world where these guys are just forced to march this death march. And I really appreciate that the movie like goes to great lengths to point out that like there are like these there are no villains among these boys. They're all like being ground up in the same meat grinder that is the system that they're part of.
Yeah, absolutely. So BJ, what did you think about the characterizations and kind of what these guys represented, and did that stuff work as well for you?
Oh yeah. I love these boys. They are all my children. I will protect them all. including Barkovich. I love them all so much. Like Chris said, I think the combination of some of the characters, because they do, you know, scale it back from 100 competitors to 50. I think that was so much smarter to do for a movie version. I think 100 would have been way, way too much. But the thing I like the most is that when you have Ben Wang is like Hank Olsen, who's got, you know, the kind of laughable accent, which feels very out of place because they are all marching in this like rural state. It is this reminder that what we are seeing is just a microcosm of the world at large, and that this horrible life of this oppressive regime is not just affecting these small rural communities. It's also affecting people in big cities. It's affecting people like Collie Parker, who grew up on the res. It's affecting people in the South. Like, it's, I think it's so smart to have these very, very distinct personalities and these voices specifically, because you need, we need that reminder that we are all being oppressed under the same systems, regardless of where we are at geographically. And I think the movie's decision to do that is very, very smart. But yeah, I don't believe that there are any true villains here. I think that this movie becomes a very fascinating look at the prisons of masculinity and the way that so many of them are like putting on airs or putting on a performance to appease, you know, the other men in their group and the boys in their group. And then this walk strips you bare and you no longer have things to hide behind, you know, this machismo that, you know, Barkovich puts on. You can't hide behind that at the end, because ultimately, like, it doesn't matter. It will not save you. What might save you is being a good person and like building community and having allies and having people that are going to watch your back. Those are the things in this world that are going to save you, because we have to work together. I think it is so like breathtaking to watch in its tragedy.
Yeah, I think that's maybe a good transition point into talking a little bit about the performances. And I guess the main two we should touch on first are from Cooper Hoffman and David Johnson, who play Garrity and DeVries, respectively. And I was just wondering what you all thought about them. I thought Cooper Hoffman was really good. There's a moment where he is talking about his character's dad and his character's dad going out of his way to teach his son about art and music and the beauty in life and all these things that have been banned from this futuristic or alternate hellscape society that these people are living in. And it just, it kind of hit me like a sledgehammer, just thinking about him being the son of Philip Seymour Hoffman and there probably being some truth to that. I don't know what their real life relationship was like, but I think that was maybe a piece of metatextual stuff that went into that bit of casting that worked really well for me as a viewer. Just made that line hit even harder. And then David Johnson, I know from movies like Rye Lane and the most recent Alien film. And he was on Industry, the HBO show, which I tried to get into and just could not get into at all. And I actually did not like him, his performance or his character very much at all. And I was like, do I even like this actor? It was like that much of a turnoff performance for me, but he really pulled out of a nosedive for me in this movie. I thought he was great. So what'd you guys think about those two performers?
Yeah, they're great. I think everyone in this movie is bringing their, I don't think there's like a single bad performance in this movie, but those two guys are so great and they have such great chemistry together. One thing the movie does that's really smart is it really leans into that friendship a bit more than the book. Those two characters, they do become friendly in the book, but there are long stretches of the book where, you know, Garrity is the main character in the book. And there are long stretches in the book where Garrity is sort of like walking on his own and he's like lost in his own thoughts because, you know, that's how Stephen King writes. He gets into the minds of his characters and he shows us their, you know, inner monologues. And in the film, those two characters are pretty much like joined the hip almost through the entire movie. Like they share the screen almost for the entire film. They're basically like co-leads and it makes us like identify with both of them. It just makes like the eventual inevitable ending all the more wrenching because we know, you know, the only way to win the long walk is to be the last guy standing. So we know that one of these two are likely to be the last two left because the movie is focusing on them so much. And that means one of them is going to have to die. And the fact that the movie, you know, makes a point of having them be the two main characters, it makes it all the more important. Like in the book, Pete, the David Johns character, actually just gives up. He sits down and allows himself to get shot. In the movie, he keeps going with Ray through the end, and they get to that ending, and he has that moment where he hangs back and he looks like he's gonna sacrifice himself. And I saw this with a crowd the second time, and the crowd like was just like yelling. They were like, "No!" And they're just like freaking out. And Ray runs back to get him, and then of course, you know, Ray is the one who hangs back and sacrifices himself. And that, you know, that whole sequence is just, it's just heartbreaking. This movie in general is just heartbreaking, but those two guys play off each other so well. I bought into that friendship really easily. Like I really believe that these two guys like just had this back and forth really well together. That I was really like that part where they're going up the incline, the hill, and Ray has that sort of like freak out moment where he just like yells at Pete and he's like, you don't care if I live or die. And he's sort of like having a panic attack and he breaks off on his own. And then like out of nowhere, Pete comes up behind him and helps him get to the top. Like I got like emotional in that moment. Cause I was just like the idea that he has this friend, like helping him through that moment is so like, it's so powerful to have that scene in the movie is like, and like, it wouldn't work as well if the performances weren't as good as they were. Like, you know, those actors weren't as good as embodying those characters as they are. I wouldn't really like care as much, but like, I'm with them every step of the way. Like I want to see what's going to happen to them.
They're so phenomenal. This movie does not work without the two of them at the center, which is also kind of how the book functions. And Pete, as a character, has always been like, he's far more overt in the book, but he's a gay character. And I think the way that they play this relationship in the movie is so smart because there are these little moments where it's like, this is clearly like friendship. This is foxhole friendship like you would in the war. Also, they understand each other on a level that like the other guys are just not fully aligning with them on. And then there are even moments where like this is teetering on romance, like this is a love story. And so when they do have this ending where essentially Ray is like sacrificing himself for Pete to survive, it is so heartbreaking because it's palpable for the audience that this relationship is so important. Like this is like the once in a lifetime friendship that you have. It's the once in a lifetime relationship that you have. And I think Americans especially, like we don't value our friendships like from a societal level the way that we do our romantic relationships. But like the love you have with your best friend can be as powerful, if not more so, than the love that you have with like, you know, your romantic partners. And this movie captures that beautifully. And the two of them are so good. So, so good in this. It is just absolutely gut-wrenching. And like Chris said, like it is a different ending than the book. So like I was fully prepared. I also saw this movie twice because it's a hyperfixation of mine now. But I saw it the first time and book order, Pete dies, then Stebbins, Ray wins. So when Stebbins died before Pete, that's when I had my clue of, I actually have no idea where they're going to go with this ending, and now I'm not emotionally prepared. Like, there's no armor for me to protect myself, and I'm so obsessed with this relationship, and I love these characters, and I love these boys, and now this ending is going to be so much harder for me, and I was a disaster the first time I saw it. Honestly, I was a bigger disaster the second time I saw it, because now I could, like, really pay attention to, like, the little intricacies of their performances that I missed the first time. My God, they are both so fantastic. I do think that David Johnson, like, this is such a star-making movie for him. He was already great in Alien Romulus. I actually heard that he had gotten sent, like, a copy of Alien Romulus while they were filming The Long Walk, and that's how he saw it for the first time, and everyone was like, hey man, you're really good in this movie, which I think is so cute and sweet. But yeah, if people weren't already on board with him as, you know, the best part of Alien Romulus, this movie is gonna blow people away.
Yeah, they're both so good. And I do want to give a shout out to the rest of the supporting cast. I mean, they are clearly the main characters here, but when Arthur comes up between them near the very end of the movie, he's one of the last remaining ones, and you can tell that the movie is leading up to a moment where Arthur is going to die. That's where the true waterworks started for me. And that's a character that is just subtly woven through the story. He's there. He's certainly one of the supporting cast members, but I was not expecting how emotionally devastated I was at the loss of Arthur, this kind of side character, and that really snuck up on me. I was wondering if either one of you had that same reaction to that character's death and that whole scene where he's basically, like, between those guys being held up by them as he is kind of walking his final steps, you know?
Yeah, that scene is wonderful. It's just a beautiful, very sad scene that really got to me. There's one other scene I would talk about. I'll let BJ talk about this scene, but there's one other scene I do want to talk about after this that really got to me.
Yeah, I'll talk about Arthur, and then I'll talk about my other one that got to me, because maybe we're the same one, maybe they're not. But the Arthur scene gets me because The Long Walk is also a great exploration in all of our relationships with death, because so many of the people who die in this movie are terrified. They are so scared. And Arthur's not, because he's very religious. He even says, like, I'm going home, because he clearly believes in heaven. He's going to go, you know, be reunited with Heavenly Father. And, like, it's so heartbreaking, but at the same time, it is so beautiful. And I don't know, maybe this is the, you know, formerly terminal cancer patient medical miracle in me speaking, but being able to control and have a say in when you go is something I feel very strongly about. And watching him be okay, I don't know, it was, like, heartbreaking, but there's something, like, weirdly healing in watching that.
Yeah, and just, like, the notion of passing on that necklace and just passing it to these friends that he's literally made along the way, which is a joke that we've all been saying for years, but, like, this movie really is about the friends he made along the way. And yeah, there's just something very powerful about the idea of legacy and the continuation of that. It really messed me up. So BJ, why don't you go on with the other moment and see if it matches up with Chris's.
Yeah, so the other one that really gets me in this one is when Jordan Gonzalez's character passes away. Jordan Gonzalez plays the character who's like, oh, I'm going to write a book about The Long Walk. And everyone's like, hey, you don't have to do that. Like, if you write this book, because he's like, yeah, I'm going to be rich and famous writing this book. He's his character's name is Harkness. He's like, yeah, I'm going to write this book from the inside. I'm going to make me a millionaire. And everyone's like, if you win, you don't need that. And, like, it's this beautiful notion of, like, yeah, you're not thinking that far ahead because you're a teenager. But Jordan Gonzalez is a trans actor. And a lot of people don't know that. And I love that the movie doesn't ever acknowledge it, doesn't ever make a point out to it. There's no asterisk about his inclusion in The Long Walk. He's a boy with the rest of the boys. And seeing him welcomed into the group and being a part of it, like, like, especially with everything that's going on right now politically, it was just something really beautiful to see. And watching him go with his broken ankle and he's trying so hard, just it's a visual that broke me on like a very fundamental level in a way that I was not preparing, because that was also like, it's teased in the trailer, is walking with the broken ankle, but it just felt very apt for everything that's going on, about how many people I know in the trans community that are metaphorically at the disadvantage walking through this life with a broken ankle and still have to worry about being punished for it, for something they didn't ask for. I think his performance is absolutely beautiful, and I love that they cast him in this movie. I also love that they've not really drawn a lot of attention to it as like a gimmick. They're just allowing him to be, and like that just rules.
Yeah. What about you, Chris? What was the moment you were thinking of?
My moment involves Judy Greer, the great Judy Greer. I actually wrote a whole piece about this. I wrote a whole piece about this. It's going up on Slash Film. I don't know when this podcast is going to run. It might be up by the time this podcast run. But Judy Greer has a very small part in this film, as is her MO. She's always small supply in her films. She plays Ray's mom. She drops him off, and then she shows up two more times. One is in a flashback scene, and the second time she shows up is the scene that really, really got to me. And it's when the remaining walkers get to Ray's hometown. And, you know, the whole time they're walking, Ray has been talking about, like, you know, we're going to get to my hometown. My mom's going to be there. And right before they get there, they have this conversation where it's like, it might actually be hard to see your mom rather than a good thing. And Ray, and that sort of like confuses Ray, because he actually hadn't considered that. And sure enough, when they get there, he sees Judy Greer standing on the side of the road, and, you know, he gives her a little wave, and she's visibly upset because he's like lost his shoes at this point. And one of the rules of the long walk is, you know, if you step off the road, you're killed instantly. And at first, you know, Ray, he keeps walking, and then he can't do it anymore. He turns around and he runs to her, and he just keeps asking for a hug. And Pete is pulling him back, and she also knows that if he steps off the road, he'll get killed. So she's backing away, and everyone is screaming at the same time, and a guard is pointing a gun at him. And the fact that, like, there's this panic in the air that, like, all he wants is to get near her. And she obviously wants to get near him, but she knows she can't be near him, because if that happens, he'll die. It was like a punch, like, in the stomach and the face at the same time. It was like, I was not prepared for how raw an emotion that was, because, like, in that scene is not in the book. Like, he does see his mom when he's walking, but it's not he does not have that good of a relationship with his mom that he does in the movie. And like, it really, really got, it just like really fucking upset me. And that builds into like a great little scene between Cooper Hoffman and David Johnson, where, you know, Pete talks about, like, you know, the good things that are in the world, even though the world is a terrible place and all this stuff. So just that whole sequence is just like phenomenal.
Judy Greer screaming, "Keep walking, it's okay." I was gonna like throw up. I was like, what? I can't handle this. One of my like my kryptonites in movies, it's with any character, but it's definitely emphasized when it's boys, because men are taught to bottle up their feelings. When people call out for their moms when they're sad, like, it's why the opening to Scream like fucks me up royally when she's on the phone calling for her mom. But when he is facing her and she's just like, "Oh my God, keep walking," I was like, I can't handle this. This is so much. And the second time I saw it, even though knowing it was going to happen, just obliterated me. Judy Greer always should have been the lead. What a talent she is. God.
Yeah, shout out to JT Molnar, who wrote the screenplay here. He's the guy behind Strange Darling, which came out either last year or the year before. It sounds like he really plussed up the original novel in some ways that made this movie especially effective. So as we get to the end of our conversation here, I want to talk about the ending of this movie. And I expect some people may have strong feelings about the way this thing ends, because in a typical story, I feel like there would be some attempt to try to take down the entire corrupt system that's caused this whole situation in the first place. There's always like a cathartic thing as a viewer when you experience that in these stories, but it's not always super realistic. And this movie takes a more realistic path, which is it's not practical to overthrow the whole system because it's too deep-rooted, basically. And sometimes the best you can do is just kill the piece of shit authority figure who is ruling over this whole thing. And like, without getting on a government watch list, I wonder if we can have a conversation about what how effective that was and what that means and kind of how it stands out from other stories that are kind of in this same vein, and if you all had any thoughts about that.
You know, the my thoughts about the ending are It's a little conflicting, because it's cathartic to see Pete kill the Major, because everyone hates the Major. It's like, you know, it's easy to hate the Major. He's a bad guy. But there is a tragedy there, because that during that scene I just mentioned where Pete is telling Ray about the good things in life, he gives Ray this whole speech about, like, if you win the long, because like, Ray tells Pete his plan to kill the Major, and Pete tells him, you know, if you win, you should just take the money and go home to your mom and forget about this. He gives him this whole speech about how revenge doesn't solve anything. But in the end, revenge is exactly what Pete chooses. So it's not really the best ending. Like, yeah, it's good that he killed the Major, but he also sort of like corrupted his own outlook on life in the end. So it's like, I don't really, it's not like the triumphant ending that some people could read it as. Like, when I saw that second time, there was like someone behind me clapping after he shot Mark Hamill, and I was like, I don't think you understand what's happening during this scene.
Yeah.
Person clapping. So yeah, I'm very curious, like, to see how people interpret that ending.
Oh man, I feel totally opposite about this ending. Okay. I love this ending so very much, because the thing that I hate the most in the world is people who believe that if you are oppressed, that you're supposed to take it lying down, be the bigger person, turn the other cheek. Absolutely not. You go low, I am dragging you to hell with me. How dare you? I especially think it's powerful because in the book, Pete is not written as a Black character. Being cast as a Black character, it completely changes the politics of this. And Black people, queer people, anybody who's oppressed are always forced into these boxes of model minorities of, you know what? You're really bad. I'm not going to be like you. I'm not going to be bad to you. No, you have to learn to speak the language of your oppressor. And unfortunately, that means sometimes fighting fire with fire, because they don't get the message any other way. And so I do think that there is a little bit of a corruption that takes place in that, like, Pete's view about, like, you know, the inherent goodness of people or how you have to do something good. That's all fine and dandy. I do still think that that part of him is here. But I think losing Ray is when he realizes, oh, wait, no. That's actually not going to change anything. Me choosing goodness does not bring Ray back. Me choosing goodness does not make this walk change. The only thing that happens is if I take down this symbol, because I can't take down the system, but at least I'll have done something. I felt like I could flip a building after I watched the ending of this movie, because I could not believe that a movie actually allowed an oppressed character to be justified in their rage, to be justified in the fact that they're like, no, I'm not going to play nice with my oppressors. Fuck these people. Like, oh my God, I love it so much. It's so bold. It's not going to sit well with everybody, but we literally never let characters do this. We never let them actually express their anger and their frustration. That is absolutely righteous and justified.
Yeah, the bold thing is not having Pete immediately shot by the other soldiers. I kind of was expecting that, like bracing myself for that, because that's kind of what would happen in that. That is what would happen in real life. But this, especially with a black man doing this, right? Like, there's just absolutely no way that there'd be any other scenario, any other ending for that scenario. But the way that this movie ends with Pete doing that and then just continuing to walk, which I understand is kind of how the book ends too, right? With Ray, like, basically continuing to walk, not with the major stuff, but just the book ends with Ray walking. I've not read it, but he just kind of like is.
Yeah, he keeps walking because there's also this like vague, like ominous figure in the distance. And Ray's like, I think I have to keep walking because he can't fully process that he's won. It's like vaguely supernatural. Stephen King's not great with endings, self-admitted. So like, yeah.
But yeah, this one is so powerful because Pete is able to do that and then quote unquote get away with it. Like, he continues to walk. Like, yes, probably he's not going to win the prize money that he was owed or whatever, but he keeps walking, he keeps going, and the movie ends with him alive. So it's an incredibly bleak situation on one hand, because who is the version of Pete that's actually walking away? It's a version where his innocence has been obliterated, basically, and then, but he also gets to walk away. So I'm very torn about how I feel about it, because it's what Chris said and what you said at the same time, BJ. It's really
and I mean, like, here's the thing, like, he can't take the system down, of course not, but no cult has ever survived a change in leadership, so put that in your pocket.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I wonder what would happen the next day in the story of this world. Is the system in fact so deep rooted that another major would pop up, or is this action by Pete so disruptive that maybe it shakes this whole thing to its foundation and actually becomes a bigger change than we're able to see just within the confines of the story? I don't know. Okay. Any closing thoughts before we wrap up? We've been talking for a while here. I apologize for keeping you guys on so long, but this is like a really big movie. So
the only thought that I have, and again, this piece might be live by the time people hear this, or it might be, you know, being published, who knows. But I do have a piece coming up about how I hope this movie at minimum gets nominated for the inaugural Best Achievement in Casting Oscar, because that is a new award that is coming this year. And my reasoning for it is that there are so many great movies this year with so many incredible casts, but all of them are like established names, Hollywood A-listers, people who've worked with those same directors many times before and know each other's strengths. The fact that this movie is so effective and the cast is majority unknowns, if not relative unknowns, even our two, like, you know, leads in this are people that the average Joe are not familiar with their work. And all of them had to audition. Nobody was like offered. I think Mark Hamill was offered, but that's, you know, that's just his own thing. But this ensemble cast was assembled by a casting director, and this casting director was also supposed to be the casting director for both the Andre Orvidal and the Frank Darabont version. So this is somebody who clearly knows this script inside and out. That is what we should be giving Oscars for, not just, oh, great, Oscar award-winning director assembled Oscar award-winning, you know, cast of Hollywood A-listers. Like, yeah, no shit, that's going to be good. This is a risk. This is impressive.
Yeah, I would love it if it starts off on the right foot by acknowledging the people behind this movie instead of just, yeah, falling into the same type of Oscar nonsense that you see across several other categories. But man, I'm so curious how they filmed this, because it just seems like a lot of walking, and it seems
in
like kind of tough to
they filmed it to in shoot sequence. Them.
Wow. Okay. It seems tough to just like shoot a movie constantly on the move like this. So I'll have to dive into some of the making of and behind the scenes and all of that. But yeah, just fascinating stuff all around. So cool. Well, I think that's going to bring us to the end of this segment. Thank you very much. And I will talk to you both later on. I'm joined now by Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
All right, Brad, I was fully planning to see Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues. You and I had a great conversation about the first Spinal Tap movie not too long ago, and I didn't see the movie because I heard it was terrible, and I know you saw it.
Who told you it was terrible?
That's the sense that I've gotten, man, from all the reactions and stuff, not all of them, but most of the reactions that I've seen, I've just heard it's like not even close to the original. So I wanted to have you on because you had a chance to see the movie. I think you wrote about it for Slash Film, and I wanted to see if you could convince me to see it, because I think my sense is you liked it a little bit more than the general public did.
I like it a lot. I think it's a perfectly good sequel. Like, here's the thing. You're never going to make a movie that matches up to the greatness of one of the greatest comedies of all time. Like, we talked about this before. This is Spinal Tap was like a groundbreaking mockumentary. There had never been a movie like it before. It's a classic, you know, it perfectly sends up the entire genre of rock documentaries, has these great characters in it. It's entirely improvised. The songs are incredible, despite the fact that it's a comedy movie. Like, they Christopher Guest, Michael McKean, and Harry Shearer play and sing like a real rock band. You're not going to top that, and it's going to be really hard to come close to it. And comedy sequels are hard by nature. Having said that, I think this is a perfectly fine, very entertaining sequel. If it has one major shortcoming, it's that the emotional core of the movie isn't as strong as the first one. It kind of feels like they're treading similar territory by having another riff of sorts between Michael McKean's character and Christopher Guest's character. And it never really feels like it has something that grabs you and feels real. That's the one big problem with the movie. But it's still incredibly funny. It's not loaded with these cameos that are distracting. The cameos that are in it from real rock stars serve a purpose, and they're funny and sweet. And if there's one thing I think that this movie accomplishes in a different way than the first one, is it has a different kind of sweetness to it that the first one doesn't have. Because even though they're in their 40s, and this is Spinal Tap here, they're, you know, 40 years older. And there's something that's just like nice about watching them get back together, especially when they have like jam sessions. And even when they're bickering and fighting about stuff with the songs that they're doing for the reunion show and everything, there's just something that's really sweet about watching them work together. And it has that same sense of authenticity that the first one does. So yeah, and plus it's got a 66% on Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, you know, for a comedy sequel, that's pretty damn good, you know. I don't know who you're listening to. They're probably drunk. Maybe they're flat out stupid. but no, I thought this was it's a very entertaining movie, very funny. I think it's absolutely worth seeing. So yeah, don't listen to anybody
except okay. me. Well, yes, of course. Yeah, it's interesting that you say that it's kind of sweet to watch these characters 40 years older, because there have been so many legacy sequels over the past few years that oftentimes I find myself seeing characters reprise their roles all these years later. And it just kind of, I feel sad more than anything else. Like, that's not the intention that the filmmakers have, but just seeing the passage of time and seeing these characters try to recapture their glory days, there's just something about that that it so rarely works that it often just ends up feeling more sad than exciting or funny or whatever the case may be.
I think that's what's great about the I think the framework for what these movies are helps that, because like they, you know, they definitely aren't trying to pretend like they're still these young rock stars. They're definitely older. Their relationships, you know, have aged in that way. You know, they're not necessarily super excited about getting back together either. Like, the reason that the reunion show happens is kind of by happenstance, and they're doing it a little bit reluctantly because they haven't talked to each other in a while. And so it's accomplished in a way that it still taps into this genuine feeling of like what you would see among real bandmates who maybe, you know, have been estranged for a while, and seeing them reconnect and, you know, try and work together again. It's not like, you know, Happy Gilmore 2 where like everybody's getting back together and like the energy is like full blast. They're like, let's do all the old shit that we did before, you know? And so like they did a good job of doing a sequel that feels like a sequel that isn't just tapping into like all the greatest hits from the original movie, you know, repeating gags and stuff like that. You know, there's a couple things that like allude to previous stuff in the original movie, but it all works. I was really, really happy with it.
I was actually going to end this conversation by saying I was worried that it was going to be a Happy Gilmore 2 type of situation. So it's funny that you brought that movie up already. It sounds like it's not doing that, because I think that's like your most hated movie of the year, right?
Oh, it's my most hated movie probably of the 21st century.
Wow. Holy cow. Okay. Yeah, man, I knew that you didn't like that movie, but over the past 25 years, that just that jumped considerably to the top of the hated column there.
Absolutely. And it's great. And it's not okay. It's not even just because it's bad. It's just because there's so much wasted potential.
Yeah. Well, do you think Spinal Tap 2 capitalized on the potential that it had? I mean, it has been a long time. And do you think that the people who are excited about seeing this movie are going to walk away satisfied? Or do you think that anybody's going to be disappointed at all in terms of like, oh, man, there are so many different directions they could have gone with this. And the direction that they took, I wasn't crazy about it. Do you think there's more meat on the bone for a Spinal Tap 3? Like, what do you think about all that?
I don't think Spinal Tap 3 is necessary. It's definitely like there's always the open possibility for it just because of, you know, that's just how rock bands work and whatnot. They probably have to have a really good reason to do a third one at this point. And I think that for the most part, fans of the original movie will be fairly satisfied. The screening that I went to in Chicago was on September 10th, and it was the like advanced preview IMAX screening that was like supposed to be like for a big fan thing, and they had a live stream Q&A with the cast in character, and Rob Reiner also in character as his filmmaker persona, Marty DeBerge. So, you know, that was, the energy there was great. People were laughing really loud and enjoying it and clapping and even, you know, cheering. So I think that the people who are, you know, definitely longtime fans of Spinal Tap will walk away and be satisfied.
Cool. All right. Well, any final thoughts, any moments or aspects that you can talk about here without really giving anything away? It's kind of tough talking about a comedy without giving a joke away or something, but anything that stood out to you?
The ending in particular was rather surprising to me. I was not expecting what happens at the very end of the movie. And it's hilarious. So that was something that I was pretty pleased with and definitely was not expecting. There's an incredible joke that had me laughing so hard that's just in the credits. And seeing the credits again, just like the first movie, it makes me like anticipating the home media release, because I'm sure they shot so much more footage. Like, there's going to be so many deleted scenes. There's hours of deleted scenes from the first Spinal Tap since they shot so much for that movie. So I can't wait to see what they have for this one. But in one of the interviews, Michael McKean's character, David St. Huppins, is talking about how he was inspired to write a book about his experiences in rock and stuff like that. And he was inspired after he read Bruce Springsteen's book. And he says, I am Springsteen going on Spreventeen. it just hit me right in the sweet spot. I just laughed so hard because it's such a silly, random joke.
That's so stupid. Oh, man. Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Brad. I hope that maybe if there's anybody else listening who had heard similar things to me or maybe was on the fence, that maybe people will be convinced to go check this out.
Yeah, don't listen to the negativity. Just go see Spinal Tap 2. It's like it's totally worth it. You'll have a good time.
All right, cool. Well, thanks very much, Brad. I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
All right, BJ, I've got you back with me because we need to talk a little bit about Gen V Season 2, which has premiered and is the first few episodes are up on Prime Video as people are listening to this. And I have not seen any of the show. I've not seen any of the boys yet somehow, despite everyone saying they think that I would probably love or appreciate the show. But I know that you were a big fan of Gen V Season 1. So let me ask you before we get into the rest of it, what do you think about the second season? Do you think it's an improvement on season one? Maybe like staying at the same level, a little worse? Where do you fall there?
Honestly, I think season two is even better than season one. And it is shocking that they are able to pull off what they do with this season, because there were some pretty big changes that had to happen due to real life circumstances. Chance Perdomo, who was on season one, it sort of felt like season two was going to be set up to be a season centered on him, unfortunately passed away in a tragic accident. So they kind of had to go back to the drawing board and completely restructure season two. And even without that knowledge, I think the story of season two is a lot stronger. And that is, again, it's wild to say that because season one was so good. I really like the boys a lot, like quite a bit. I love Gen V.
Okay. So how much connective tissue is there between the two shows? Like, in its second season, has Gen V really become more of its own thing, or are characters from The Boys still showing up, or like, what's the distinction there at this point?
So they both are set in the exact same world. So they have a lot of the same politics, and things that are happening in the world around them are affecting both of their storylines. There are occasional crossovers with characters from The Boys that kind of pop up on Gen V, but it very much is kind of its own thing set within this world. But, you know, it's like real life. Everything is connected because we are focusing on this university, which many members of like The Boys' extended universe that we see, a lot of them either attended this school or maybe they come back and they teach at the school occasionally. Like, there's definitely a scene in a frat house this season, and you see that the Deep was president of this frat for, like, I think it's like 5 or 6 years, so you know that he was in college for longer than 4 years because he didn't finish in four. Like, little things like that kind of pop in, but really it is a lot of the politics of, you know, what's going on in the world of The Boys is going to affect all of the soups at Godolkin University.
So what about the tone? Is it funnier, or is it able to kind of carve out its own lane in terms of the tone of the show, or are the tones very different because the world that they both operate in are so kind of heightened?
So their tones are very similar in that both shows are incredibly graphic in its depiction of violence and gore. They're both very, very sexual. They're both very, very funny. But the difference being is sort of just embedded in the DNA of who these characters are and what they're going through, because The Boys were dealing with adults, and Gen V were dealing with college students. So there is sort of this coming of age aspect that is affecting the stories of Gen V that you're not going to see quite as much in The Boys. And also, you are never as radical as when you're like 19 years old. That is when you have the most passion in your life and you're the most defiant. You're the most emotionally driven. You're the going to take risks that you probably would not have if you were somebody in your, you know, late 30s, early 40s. And so that does change a bit of the tone of the series. And I think it's probably why I like it so much more, because that's very much, you know, I love coming of age stories, but I also just love characters that are still figuring themselves out in a lot of ways. And that is crucial to this series.
So I don't have much more to say about this because I haven't seen it, but I do want to give you some room to talk a little bit about the show without spoiling it. I think we've done a good enough job so far of not giving anything away. So maybe we can keep that up and then just kind of tell me what you thought about some of the plot lines this season, anything you can say really without ruining the experience for people.
Yeah, sure. So one of the things that I love about Gen V is that because it is a spinoff of the world of The Boys, but is not directly inspired by, you know, the comic series of The Boys, it really is able to be its own thing and tell its own stories. It is not beholden to any, you know, original source material. And I think that makes the stories better, and it also makes them a lot more timely. I think that Gen V is really good at figuring out the ways that, I mean, superhero stories are always a reflection of the world around us, and they are always in direct conversation or a response to whatever is going on in the real world. And Gen V is so timely, and it's able to explore in ways that I think The Boys, if they were really let off the leash, could do more often. But for example, they introduce a character in the season of Gen V. It's in like the first episode, so it's not a spoiler, but she's teaching like their social media class, because they, you know, when you're a soup, you also have to know how to have a good public persona. So they have a class teaching them how to be better social media marketers, but she's taught by a soup who goes by Modesty Monarch, and she's a trad wife. And so it's this really fascinating look at the way that like the trad wife movement is absolutely targeting young college age students in the hopes of like setting them on that path for their adulthood. So there's a lot of little stuff like that incorporated that I think is really interesting. But ultimately, we have all of our core group back together. They are in mourning after the passing of their friend, because something that I do really respect the show for doing is that they did not recast Chance. They instead wrote into the story that his character, Andre Anderson, has died. And so you're also watching not just these characters, but also these actors have to grapple with what happens when somebody that like you really care about and you really love and is part of your team passes away in an untimely fashion. And I think it really, it makes the story feel all the more real, even though I think Gen V has always felt eerily real in the way that it's handling things. But also this season is a big reflection on the way that young people and especially college students are being attacked for, you know, their right to a peaceful protest and certain people who don't believe that they should be allowed to have that constitutional right. But with superheroes, so obviously the stakes are a lot higher. It also explores a lot of themes of people in power who want to manipulate and take over young people for their own nefarious reasons, because young people have consistently always been treated as, you know, whether it's drafting them for a war they didn't ask for or, you know, manipulating them to do your bidding. You never know. That's a lot of what's going on this season, and watching, you know, the group of people we've all loved so dearly fight against that, as well as a couple of hopes for redemption for some of our characters who, you know, went down the wrong path at the end of season one.
Okay, so before we get into the interviews that you did, I was curious about, you mentioned this show kind of feels like it can do some things that maybe The Boys can't quite do, maybe because it's hamstrung in some way. Is that because The Boys just has more seasons, so it has more narrative to carry, and this show is comparatively fresher, and it's only in its second season now, so it has like a little bit more room to explore some things? Is that what you meant by that?
What I mean is, because The Boys is based on existing source material, there are storylines and plot points and trajectories of characters that they kind of have to follow. Obviously, there's some fudging creatively that happens, but by and large, if you've read the comics, like, you kind of know where The Boys is heading at any given moment. Versus Gen V, they don't, it's not based on anything. These are entirely new characters created specifically for this show, entirely new storylines created specifically for the show, so they can kind of do whatever they want. Like, they don't have, they're not beholden to any sort of like, oh, you know, this is how, you know, Bruce Wayne's parents die. Like, there's none of that for this.
Interesting. Okay. For some reason, I had thought that The Boys had already surpassed its source material, but that seems to not be the case. So that's fascinating. I don't know where why I thought that. So anyway, I should probably watch the show. It sounds good. So yeah, I'll definitely add that to my list. So you had a chance to speak with several people involved with the making of this and some of the actors and stuff. There's one group that you spoke to that kind of gave you some spoilery answers. So we're not going to play that interview now. We may end up featuring some of the quotes and stuff in an article at Slash Film. So I encourage people to just check out slashfilm.com as usual. But you do have two groupings here, one with Sean Patrick Thomas and Hamish Linklater, and then one with Lizzie Broadway, Maddie Phillips, and Asa German. So who do you think we should go to first here, BJ?
Let's kick things off with the adults of this group, and let's talk to Hamish Linklater, who plays one of my favorite villains that I've seen this year. Oh my God. I mean, he's always great, but like, he's so good. But then also Sean Patrick Thomas, who, for those who are not familiar with the show, he plays the father of Andre Anderson, so the character who has passed away. So he has a really fantastic arc this season as Polarity.
Okay, so here is BJ's chat with Sean Patrick Thomas and Hamish Linklater.
So Polarity and Cypher represent two dramatically different pathways that adults can choose when regarding their relationship with younger generations, supporting and guiding, or treating them like soldiers instead of students. So I would love to hear from you, Sean, about anyone in your life who was there to guide you when you were younger, or maybe a character you were trying to emulate. And then Hamish, who are the villains that you are channeling because My God, you are good at playing evil this season.
Well, I mean, I guess my mentors growing up will obviously be my father and my grandfather. My grandfather in particular was very, very proud. And he was kind of a warrior in another sense. And he really, he used to tell me, he's from Guyana. My family's Guyanese. And he'd say, Shawnee, you mustn't just be on the team. You must be the captain, you know? And every time he talked to me like in those terms. And that really kind of shaped just my attitude and my approach towards everything.
I love that. And Misha, about you? Why are you so evil this season?
Because that's what they paid me to do. Yeah, no, in terms of channeling, I don't know. I was thinking about the Rat Pack a little bit and Dean Martin. And then, you know, but then just be like, you know, turn on the news. Try to act like those guys.
Well, it's effective and it comes across because, you know, comic book stories, superhero stories, so many of the villains are deeply rooted in real people. But you don't come off like a comic book villain. You come off as a real person. So mission accomplished there. Oh, and then so I have time for like one last question. I would love to know what it's like for the two of you who are such seasoned pros to work with this incredible young cast who very much feel like this is the next generation of Hollywood superstardom.
Well, for sure. I mean, these guys, you kind of get into a groove when you've been doing this for a while, and they have so much fresh energy and fresh ideas that it kind of just kind of jolts you out of whatever you know, road that you've been on. And all of them in different ways just kind of just wake you up and make you enjoy the process in a whole different way. And they're spectacular.
Yeah, they take meticulous notes in their scripts. And it's just like wild, the preparation that each one of them brings to bear on each of the scenes. It was really impressive.
Are there any things that they have been able to, you know, teach the two of you after all these years, like something maybe that they do that you're like, ooh, maybe I should give that a try on my next role?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot, actually. There's a lot. You know, it's like they like know about lenses, you know, they know about they want to like know where the camera is. Yeah. And you just like they've read everything and they've seen everything, and you know, they take pity on us sometimes and let us in on a few craft secrets. But
yeah,
I love very that impressive. Has there ever been anything in the script, because this is such a contemporary work that's constantly referencing things from real life, have you ever needed to lean on them for them to, you know, explain a joke or maybe a reference to something that you were not familiar with?
I'm trying to remember. I mean, I know I've had stuff to say as Polarity that was kind of like a throwback from whenever he was young that I've had to explain to them. I've had that. Matchbox 2020 and stuff like that.
So good.
You know, I've had to explain to them, but I can't think of anything that I missed. I think I'm hip enough to keep up so far with what I've seen.
I love that so much. Well, that is my time with you today. Thank you so much for chatting, and congratulations on an amazing season of one of the best shows on TV right now.
Gosh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, and now we have Lizzie Broadway, Maddie Phillips, and Asa German. So anything you want to highlight from this conversation? I know you didn't really have a lot of time with these folks, so it's only like a 5-minute interview or something, but anything in particular jump out to you?
The only thing that I really was excited about is that Lizzie Broadway told me that one of my questions was profound, and I was like, oh yeah, I love when I can ask a question that makes the group really have to think about things. But it is really nice that this group especially, and I guess this entire cast, they really are all rooting for each other at any given moment. And I think that that is really nice to see. I love the relationships and the families that are formed with television casts, because they do work so intimately for such long periods of time. And these are all just great people. I cannot wait to see, you know, how the industry continues to embrace all of them.
Excellent. All right. Thanks, BJ. And here is your final interview.
The addition of a trad wife influencer, Modesty Monarch, killed me because it is such a specific brand of fascism that is currently targeting young women more than any other demo, and therefore it fits in perfectly on a show like Gen V, whereas maybe it would have felt a little forced on the boys. So I'd love to hear from each of you a moment, a situation, a joke, anything from the season that you hope resonates with people watching at home in their real lives.
Wow.
Oh, that's such a good question.
Just anything that we hope resonates with people.
Anything. It doesn't even have to be funny. It can be very serious too.
I think forgiveness is a really big one. I think that grief is
Yeah,
really
big
big
one.
one. Because, I think that it affects us all really differently in really unexpected ways, and you can see how it affects everybody differently in this show. And I think especially in this particular circumstance, I think it's gonna really resonate with a lot of people in a really big way. And
Like going off. Oh,
No,
you
you
go.
go. Well, I was going to say in terms of a joke from the show, something that I really enjoyed being a part of was the what?
Just thought of something
What?
that when you're
But
on the leash with
that's
the
what I was going to
it's
say.
like the people resonate like to
Oh
BDSM.
yeah.
Say
Well,
that.
that would
You
be
can't.
great if people resonate with bondage and
Or like Shades of Grey, you're really gonna love Gen V stuff.
leash play. Yeah, all of the fraternity stuff I think is great. I was never in the fraternity, but yeah, we shot that in a real frat house, and I think that might have been the first time I was ever in an actual frat house. It
It
was
was disgusting.
it was an experience for sure.
It smelled weird.
Yeah, I don't need to go back.
That
No.
doesn't surprise me. I
No,
feel
like
like
it was
there's
a
just.
real frat house. I think someone was like sleeping upstairs at one
They
point.
were.
Yeah,
Yep.
yeah.
And they didn't make it,
And
and we
we
were
were still there.
filming.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the
Shout out to
accountant.
that guy.
He did the
Just
accounting for
for
the
the frat
frat.
house.
Yeah.
Just
It's also
decades
like a
of
frat
cheap
name. Yeah.
beer embedded in the walls and
Exactly. Exactly.
floorboards.
100%.
So I have time for one last question, and it's a question that I already asked your colleagues because right now I think it feels like in the world that we're living in that there's not a lot of heroes for a lot of us to look up to, but you all provide that in very different ways. So how is it for you as actors to be able to bring characters to life that people genuinely want to root for because they're fighting for us too?
Wow,
It's a really
really good
profound question.
question. I mean, at least for Emma, I think it doesn't matter. It's not the people on the pedestal. It can be everyone can be a hero. It's the underdogs. And I think you see that throughout the season that heroes come in all shape and forms. And sometimes it's your really good friend seeing something in you before you see it in yourself. And I hope that these characters reflect back something in the audience to know who they are in their strength and their power.
Yeah, I really think that the lovely thing about the show is that even though it's a show about, college students with superpowers, the thing that really is the most heroic about them is that they're grappling with their humanity, and
Which is hard.
which is really hard.
Hard.
And these incredibly dire,
Hard.
life is
It's
hard,
hard.
in those dire circumstances and in this crazy kind of analogous world that they're all living in. It's a Everyone's just trying their best to reflect something positive, I think, and make the right choice, even the ones that make wrong choices sometimes. And
Mistakes are okay.
yeah, so hopefully we all get there.
I agree completely. I think that you just nailed exactly why I love the show as much as I do. And that is the time I have with you today. Thank you so much for chatting with me, and congratulations on yet another phenomenal season.
Thank
Oh,
you so
thank you.
much.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the show. If you want to hear even more from me and several of my colleagues, you can check out Pop Cultured, which is a relatively new podcast that we launched not too long ago. You can find it over at patreon.com/popcultured. We have a bunch of stuff cooking for you over there as well. So I would love to have you over there if you're interested. And yes, you can find more about the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a bunch of things in the show notes. You can subscribe to this show on Apple Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. We would love to hear from you. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. And tell your friends about the show any way you can. We really appreciate that. If you know anybody who loves movies and TV and might be interested in checking us out, shoot them a text. Say, hey, check this out. Send them a link. I think they might appreciate it, and we absolutely would. So thanks so much for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next week.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5.
I know where I'm going to bet from now on.
Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.